Session number 9796, William Spearman, Reel 3.
Yes, I never knew until Webb told me this that the bang auto never went off. But one thing he did tell me, and I'll just divert for a moment, that amongst the commanders we had people from all regiments, all volunteers from all regiments, and they'd been vetted, they'd been gone through all the training, and so we were all a bunch of volunteers. Now, we had one fellow there who was really commissioned officer material. He had a good education, which is the one thing that most of us hadn't had. This is what made the difference between a commissioned officer and a non-commissioned officer. For the moment, I can't think of the chap's name. Rather on the fat side, but a gentleman, you know, very good breeding. And he should have been an officer because of his education, I think. In retrospect, I still think it. He had certain weaknesses, of course, but I remember that... I can't think of his name, but anyway, on the boat coming over, on the mothership coming over, we'd all been fed by the Navy, and generally it's very good, except that they always seem to give you very fatty food when it's a very rough weather, so everybody kind of is sick. And of course, somebody came round with Lovett and said to this particular person who was from the lifeguards, what was the food like? He said, it wasn't fit for a dog. And everybody got very uptight about this, and they wanted to put him on all sorts of charges because he made this offensive remark to our host, the Navy. And so Gordon Webb, who was his captain, like he was my captain, in charge of the troop, got this fellow aside, and he almost threatened to court-martial him over this. I mean, it was very serious. I wasn't there. I didn't hear it, but this is what Webb told me. But he said, for the time being, he said, I overlook it. He said, but if anything dangerous is needed when we get to Dieppe, he said, you're going to bloody do it. You're going to be nominated for it. As a sort of a punishment. This is the only thing he could think of, I think, at the time. So anyway, at this Bangalore torpedo situation, Webb had told me the Bangalore torpedo never went off. So he said then, what happened? He got hold of this chap, who was a big fat chap, and he said, right, throw yourself on the wire, because we'd all done this. If somebody launches themselves across the Nanit wire, it's never usually, and this is double, it's never usually more than 6 foot long. So if somebody makes a heap in the middle of it, no matter how long it is, you can leap onto your back and leap over, you can get through. You just throw yourself on it, you know. And if you don't move, you don't get lacerated by the wire. You get ripped a bit, but nothing serious. So he was nominated to throw himself on this wire. It was an instant decision, you know, because when the Bangalore torpedo went off, I suppose. I wasn't conscious of this. But this is what Webb, I'll remind you again, this is what Webb told me. So anyway, this chap was threw himself onto the wire, and this is how we apparently, all 30 of us, funneled our way through this wire and got on with a march up to the battery. Somebody at the same time put this pillbox out of action before we left there. But what Webb said, the point I'm getting about this chap who made this horrible comment about the food which the Navy had fed us, he got so entangled to the wire after 30 people. By the way, I think 8 people got killed there, because one thing I forgot to mention, about the machine gun fire coming in, the Germans are brilliant on mortar fire. And we were very good on mortar fire, but never seemingly as good as the Germans were, because as soon as we threw ourselves down on this beach, waiting for the Bangalore torpedo, mortar bombs landed right amongst us. So it must have been pre-aimed and pre-targeted. And it just took them that slight time from the point of landing to get ready to drop the thing in. And then I divert again to say, here we were again, involved with more Canadians. And here they were expecting us. Again, you see what I mean? I mean, they were told where they were going. It was bandied about everywhere, apparently. I mean, I read about this after the war and I heard about it. So here we are. We were expected. And it was a well-defended place, in a way. This was out in the country. You wouldn't expect anything much to happen in this place, except the battery was 3 miles away, or whatever it was. Anyway, these mortar shell, which I've forgotten to tell you about in the first place, started landing amongst us, and about 8 people got killed, anyway. And the medical orderly, when we left, he had to stay behind with the wounded, who were killed and wounded then. But this chap got so entangled with the wire after everybody had run across him that he couldn't disangle, he couldn't disentangle himself. And he got quite lacerated, apparently. He must, in his struggle to get free. So they, he got left behind. And he was taken prisoner of war. And then, at the end of the day, which makes you think that Webb never really got his own back on him, you know. Anyway, we got across. I have much remembrance of this. We had to follow this sort of river for a certain distance. This was a route we knew by heart from the maps and from our own detailed plan we'd made. And, well, it's well documented now. If you look at the, our job there, we had to go along this river bed. I think it couldn't have been too flooded at the time. When we went back this year, or last year, to look at it for the first time in 44 years, it could have been folks, and I had no recognition at all whatsoever. It was pitch black when we landed, or 5 o'clock in the morning. It was very early, no light. So I assume it was the same place. Could everybody told us this where you landed, but I wouldn't have known it. It looked frightening when I went back because it was all sort of flooded with water, and you know. But when you're young, that wouldn't have meant a bloody thing at my age. Now it looks terrifying. Anyway. I wasn't a brim gunner. My main function in the commander really was I was in charge of the snipers. I was a sniper. I was a good shot. I went to Bisley on a course, and I went to Lovett's estate in Scotland shooting deer, and which was cheap labour for him, I suppose, in one way, because he had to every year or every period they have to kill so many stags if they get abundant, you know. And You used to hear about army going to Scotland and shooting at random, killing these stags and that, and I'm sure a lot of people did that, but in this case, being snipers, there was two of us sent from the commander, myself and a chap called Johnson. We worked separately. We were given 2 weeks up there, and we had to live rough off the land, so that was that training, and then we had to kill some stags, and we were given our mission to kill stags, and I fired 22 shots and killed 22 stags. Which, according to the ghillie, was commendable. The ghillie took us out the first day and showed us how to stalk the stags from one hill to another. You'd look at them through a telescope and identify the stag, the herd you were going after, and then you'd stalk it upwind, which might mean travelling a hell of a long way. But if you didn't go upwind, they wouldn't stay, you know. And I did this. Well, the first day, I suppose, dismissed that. I did this 21 times after that. And when you shoot a stag, we were shown exactly where to shoot, to hit it in the heart, behind the shoulder blade, as it were. And I did this 21 times, and not one of those stags moved. It just dropped where it was. And his instruction was, we mustn't fire over 50 yards. So we always had to start within 50 yards. That was the maximum at which to shoot a stag, because they were so strict on a stag, about wounding a stag, like the millionaires before the war used to go up there, and a lot of them weren't good shots at all. And the Gilead, you spend days then chasing these wounded animals. But in any case, just to cut the story short, we killed 21 stags with 21 bullets, which was very good. And then the two of us got together for the last day, and we stalked a herd. And there was one stag standing up, like there often is, as a sentry, and the others were sitting down eating. So we decided we'd take the sitting down ones. We'd go, I'd pick up my spot over to the right, where I'd be near to the other one. We were quite near to them, so we had to be very careful. It was very good practice. And the idea was that as soon as I raised my rifle, he was to raise, they would count three and then shoot. And that's what we did. We both got up, we both shot, and none of the stags got up. They just lurched and dropped. And then the big one looked, and we both then reloaded and took aim at him. And he also dropped. But before he dropped, he ran 100 yards, which was the only one that ever got away. And of course, both of us claimed that one. So instead of 21, I always put down as 20 we shot. So that was very good practice. And I suppose, in a way, it was cheap labour for Lord Lovett. Nothing to do with the war. Once you shot a stag, you had certain things to do, because the stags were taken to the butchers on his estate. I suppose it was revenue for him. The first thing you do when you shoot a stag and he falls over, you've got to get a blade and you've got to slit him right up the stomach. The balls you throw to the dog, because we never had any dogs, but your testicles you throw away. But the dogs used to go mad waiting for these testicles, apparently. Anyway, the first thing you do, I'm sorry, was to slit the throat. to bleed him. That was the first thing you do. Then the next thing, you put your knife in his stomach and put a slit right up his stomach, like you do when you have, when an ordinary person, when somebody's shot, you have to find out what happened. You slit them up and then they stitch him back up again. But you just slit him down. Then you have to roll up your sleeve to above the elbow, and the animal is lying on its side. You have to put your hand in all that steaming hot blood and hot flesh and innards and find out where it's connected with the kidneys and the heart. And you tear it away from there, and then the whole stomach rolls out on the floor. And then you think you break the legs. I can't think all the things you have to do. And then you drag the stag downwards, and there's always a path on the bottom of the hillside, and you leave it there. And every Saturday, the butcher used to come and pick up the animal. That was the thing. So that was another experience we got there, putting your hand into almost a living being like that. It was a most horrible experience when you were 17, 18 or 19 to do that, you know. But we did it, and I had to do it, in my case, 20 times. Anyway, so I forget now where I was telling you about the story.
You were saying on the Dieppe Raid that your speciality was as a sniper.
Oh, yeah, so following from that, I was a sniper. That's why he asked me to go up there. Went to Bisley, got a good report and all this thing, so I would always set as an example about how to shoot and that. But, of course, not to leave this stag shooting thing, it was silly to think, if you reason what I've just been telling you, that I was a sniper. I had telescopic sights and everything, but we never shot anything under 50 yards. Quite honestly, the telescopic sights in Scotland, with all the bracken and stalking and crawling for quite a long way, was an absolute waste of time. Even with a lens hood on, everything got soaked and wet, and then you were in 50 yards, you didn't need a telescopic sight. But anyway, yes, I was in charge of the snipers, and that was one of my jobs, sniping. And when we got settled in the second front, because a sniper's job then is to go out sniping and do recces and all this sort of thing, you know, dangerous, lonely work in a way, you know. But anyway, on Dieppe, I was a sniper on Dieppe. I wasn't going to be acting as a sniper there. I've just an ordinary penny packet man like everybody else, you know. Can't really think. I know exactly what we did. We were all acting together in penny packets. We all had a job to do, and in my particular group there was a machine gun, a Bren gun, and myself and other people. We were all together making our way through, you know. We weren't bunched together, but we were all together. And having got through the wire, then I remember doing a long walk, and we came into some woods. And these woods eventually led to the battery with a little bit of open ground to cover. And we got into these woods, and I think then we came under fire in these woods as we were making our way to the battery. We were lucky. We got under fire as we landed. And no doubt they warned the battery that there was a landing taking place before they were put out of action. So I'm sure the battery by this time knew we were coming. They knew we were coming anyway. But in this wood, when we came under fire, I vaguely remember quite a lot of shooting taking place. It wasn't a question of sniping. It's like Malaya, there are so many trees about, you don't snipe, you see something move and you take a shot at it. The Bren guns, of course, were most important in a situation like that, because where you had to cross open paths or open areas, and a burst of machine gun fire would keep the enemy's head down just for a moment while people were able to move and do things. You see it in all the cowboy films, you know. And this machine gun, I remember there was another guardsman in charge of the machine gun, a fellow called Chamberlain, I think his name was. And he was extremely busy in this wood. There was a lot of shooting going on. And I was within seeing distance of him when he got a stoppage on the gun. And I say, it's the most important thing in a wood in a situation like that, to have a machine gun. There's only people around. To have a machine gun is very important. And if you're good using a Bren gun, you fire in small bursts where you can keep control of where you're actually shooting to, not like you see on a film, you're little short bursts, and it's a wonderful belly machine. But there were five ways you could stop, and anybody with a Bren gun, you went through all the stoppages one by one until you found what it was that's stopping you. That's the quickest way to do it, unless you could actually identify the stoppage by experience from the start. But the idea is to go through, and the last one is overheating of the barrel. There's a sort of contraction, I think. I can't remember now why it is. I think it's a sort of contraction in the hot steel, you know, where it tightens up a bit or something, causes the bullets not to be able to enter it or something. But anyway, he went all through these, and he came to the fifth one, which changed the barrel. Now, he hadn't got a spare barrel, but he knew it must have been overheating of the barrel. So as a sideline, I remember the thing he did was he piddled into the... you have the barrel of the Bren gun, and then you have, at the end of it, you have what you call a flash eliminator. when a bullet leaves a gun, it causes a flash. But if you put this eliminator on it, it deadens the flash, so it doesn't give you a position away. But it's a little wider than the barrel, like that. And he piddled into that. And while he was piddling, he burned himself quite badly. I don't know whether it finished him for life. But funny thing, you remember a thing like this. And of course, it's completely the wrong thing to do, to piddle into a barrel, but he had no alternative. We had no there was a spare barrel around somewhere, but his number two obviously wasn't there with it, or whoever had the barrel. Because we were all loaded with explosives to blow up these half a dozen guns and grenades, and you get terribly loaded, you know. You get terribly loaded, so, and the weight you carry around is quite enormous, you know. Anyway, that's what happened in the wood. He came to the fifth stoppage on a Bren gun, and he piddled down it, and that, after he finished, the machine gun fired all right, and then we went on, and then we eventually reached the battery. Now, the idea was for our assault, it was so finely timed, because we were past masters of this, it was so finely timed that the Air Force Spitfires, I think it was, were due to come over at a certain time, and machine gun this gun battery. Now we were only, I suppose, 10 or 15 yards from the wire of this gun battery. To get across that to that wire, we would be exposing ourselves to this flak tower up which the Germans were shooting at us. So we had to sit still at this time, hidden away, because they knew we were there in the wood because of all the noise we caused and commotion. We killed all the opposition coming through that was there, and here before us lay our objective, only, you know, at the end of the garden away. But we had to wait. We couldn't go in because these machine guns, the Spitfires, were going to come over to shoot up the gun battery, to soften it up, in other words, before we assaulted it. Oh, you better. Eventually then, at the prearranged time, right to the minute, greatest admiration for the Air Force that they were able to do this, come all the way from their base in England, come to France like that, and to arrive at a gun battery at precisely the right moment. Terribly brilliant feat, I thought. And we were terrified, even though we were not at the fence at all. They opened fire, and we could see the bullets from the, what I think were Spitfires, I think they were, from these planes in a way, hitting the dust just before the wire started. If they'd have been, as I say, a little bit out and started early, they would have shot us up because they knew where we were going to be. And they picked exactly the right position to start their machining gunning. And they strafed the place. And that must demoralise the Germans beyond belief, because they knew now that we were outside the wire waiting to come in. They were out of communication now with anybody because we'd cut all the wires around the place. We'd cut them by this time. And they knew there'd been a landing. I mean, nobody else had landed yet, only us. This was long before the Canadians, of course. This is an operation on its own, but they knew we'd landed from the pillbox and then from the machine gunning in the wood, and they must have known exactly where we were, you know, in the wood waiting to come in, so they must have been really terrified. I can't remember if they strafed it once, twice, or how many times, I have no idea, but immediately the strafing finished, then we assaulted, and we had quite a lot of high wire to get up over, you know. And I must say, all pandemonium broke loose then. Captain Porteous was on the other side with F Troop. And as you know, he got a VC for what he did. And we also, it was total confusion really, because anybody who wasn't a commando, you recognise and you just kill them. People were running out of buildings, running into the buildings. Some of them were quite brave, they were trying to put up a fight, but they really didn't get a chance because there must have been 100 finely trained troops attacking all these, what must have been nearly 300 Germans who were artillery people, whose job was to fire guns, and they were all embedded in these sandbanks. And we just went through from one building to another, from one sandbank to another. And we had quite a number of casualties, of course, but, I mean, it was all over before you could say Jack Robinson. The people whose job it was to blow up the guns had set all their explosions, eventually they were blown up. We all had instructions, we were to take prisoners, but we weren't to bring two captains back or two lieutenants. They all had to be different ranks. This is a thing that sticks in my mind, because You can't look at a bloke and say, well, do I shoot you or do I take you prisoner? I mean, you don't often get a chance of taking a prisoner, you know. So that was a little bit mystifying to me. I mean, all I had to do, all that we had to do, was to kill bloody Germans. We knew there was a garrison 300 there, and we did it at all costs, but it didn't last jig time.
Do you think any of them escaped?
No, absolutely nobody escaped. They had nowhere to escape to. They couldn't get out of the wire, and they couldn't escape out of the wire. It was surrounded by all us, you know. Oh, I wouldn't have thought anybody would escape. I'm sure that after the machine gun fire, we'd have almost said with a megaphone, look, you're surrounded. How are you going to pack in? You know, I often look back and think, you know, they must have been so demoralised. In any case, we were the opposite of demoralised. We were on a high. We knew we were there. We knew there was what opposition there was. 300 Germans all in a little wire. They didn't stand a cat's chance. We just went in and did the job and just hoped that you didn't get shot yourself, you know. A lot of people did, unfortunately.
Did you feel sorry for them at all?
No, you don't have time to feel sorry for them, in a way, no. I mean, you kill people for them afterwards, you think, you know, was it necessary? Because it is vitally necessary. You know what I mean? I mean, the things that the Germans did, I mean, you can think back and you can think differently, but at the time, you're highly honed to do certain jobs. We spent all that frustrated time since we left France trying to get at grips with the Germans, going on a night raid, maybe never even seeing a bloody German. And here you were, with 300 Germans sitting in this thing who were going to be responsible for stopping this takeover of Dieppe by the Canadians, you know. I mean, we had to put a man back and there was no stopping us. There was no doubt in our minds that we couldn't do it. It's just a question of getting away without yourself being shot, being caught, you know. And then when that finished then and everything quieted down, F Troop had done their job, the explosive had been set to destroy the guns. And I must here stress my admiration for Lovett, especially on the beach where we had the Bangalore and the Dannet wiring. He was absolutely outstanding. As I say, the inclination there was to, when you landed from the boat where machine gun fire was coming into, your inclination was to dig into the shingle in order to protect yourself before you were able to go across the wire, you know. And it wasn't a question of trying to get across the wire because we had to wait for this explosion. And the machine gun fire, I said, it wasn't permanent, it was sporadic, I suppose, when they saw a silhouette. And you realise this, so you kept down. But Lovett, in order to rally everybody with his shells dropping and people getting killed, obviously, he stood up, he must be 6'2" tall, I suppose, he stood up on top of the shingle. Well, he couldn't stand on top of the shingle because the wire was there, but nevertheless, he stood bolt upright, you know what I mean, with his carbine. I think he had a carbine under his arm, you know, just rallying everybody. It took great courage to do that. So anyway, when it all quieted down at the battery then, we were in a haste now to get away. We knew we hadn't started yet. I mean, our big job was to get back. We knew by this time that the tide had gone out, and we could imagine when we got within view of the beach that there was going to be 200 or 300 yards of beach to cross. And if any reinforcements came up for this battery, then we would then, of course, be under fire, going across this beach. Anyway, from my point of view, and we were only all concerned with our own point of view, really. I mean, Lovett knew what was going on because he had a signaller with him, a radio man, and he knew exactly what was going on everywhere, presumably. Somebody must know what's going on, but you yourself are never told and you don't know. All you know that your job is being done and that's all you're concerned with. Anyway, I remember that at the end of it, we got through and all the resistance had finished. And there were a certain amount of people had prisoners. And Lovett called me over and I was with another fellow called Percy Toombs and he asked me to make my way over towards the beach and see if I could find a way they could get back to the beach. Now, the people defending the beach had cleared away so far up to the top of the cliffs and were waiting for us to get back there. But we weren't quite sure exactly how we could get back to him without being under too much fire. In other words, to get back to the away from the battery to the beach by a route which was the safest route for everybody to get down, because by this time, as you can imagine, we had prisoners to take with us, we had wounded to carry. We were a bit lumbered by this time, although we'd discarded all our explosives, all our grenades and things like that. We were still lumbered and slowed down by walking wounded, by stretcher wounded. People were carrying on, you know, made up bits of wood for stretchers. So we had to find a safe way through. And of course this wasn't pre-planned. It wasn't then up to Spearman when the thing was over to find a way back to the beach. It was just an order from Lubbock to go and do it. So I remember personally that Percy Toombs and I started making our way down. Eventually we got hailed by these people who'd made their way up from the beach to clear away. So we eventually all connected up a safe way to get back to the beach. We all got back onto the beach, and the boats, we never doubted that the ALCs wouldn't be there. We never doubted it. You know, you'd think you must have been worrying, now would the bloody boats be there? But I must here give the Navy full due. Every time, all that time we went training in Scotland or went on any exercise, they were all there on time. And when we started doing these raids and things like that, like at Boulogne, where they were under tremendous affliction by having these E-boats. No book ever mentions this. It's funny. Lovett makes very light of Boulogne. And of course, from a man, from his point of view, he wasn't personally... It wasn't a raid which was anything great. It was just a small raid. You know, nothing much was achieved. But to me, it was just a full-blown raid. You know, you had the same dangers and you were completely isolated. But from his point of view, there were greater things taking place. But why he never mentioned this about going back the second night, or anybody mentioned it, I can't believe it. But anyway, to get back to this, we got back to the beach, and you never doubted that the Navy wouldn't be there. One thing we did find out at a later stage was the Navy never got back in. They weren't able, because of the heavy fire, they weren't able to get in to our original landing spot to pick up all the wounded there. Because the plan was that if you got wounded on the way to the battery, you made your way back to the beach from where you'd come, and the Navy would come in and disembark you in due course. They never actually did get back. Their fire against them by the Luftwaffe or whoever it was, I don't know why, but they never got back in again to pick up those, so they were all taken prisoners. We didn't actually know this when we got back to the beach. We got back to the beach through way of a gully. And when you look down this gully, you know when you go to Brighton and, or Bournemouth and see all the sweep of sand, bloody long way out of the water, you know what I mean? This is my memory. When we got to this culvert, through this, we didn't have to do any cliff climbing, there was a track, and then this opening there, and then you saw this bloody long beach. Maybe it was because we were tired, and it seemed longer than what it was, but it seemed a hell of a long way to go when you were under fire, because the Germans were up on top of this cliff by this time, somewhere along, didn't actually, we bypassed them. They were actually shooting, as soon as you got on the beach, they started shooting you up. And whoever the powers to be were and the commander had to organise everything. There was a lot to be organised, and I suppose somebody was in touch with the Navy, knowing the boats were there. I think I remember seeing boats there, you know, but there was shooting going on and splashes in the water, but we had to get away from the beach. And we were happy because the raid was done and all we had to do now was to get to the boat and we'd be safe. That was your blind knowledge after a raid. One, that the Navy would be there, and once you got onto the boat, it was over. So, what happened on the beach, whoever was overall planning it, we found that there were quite a few wounded by this time and stretcher cases. They were filling the boats up. Once you got to the edge of the sand, and there came a point when it was realised there was too many people to get in these boats. All the boats, you know, I think we used to get about 30, 34 people in a boat.